This Torah class is brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.
Yom Kippur. All right. So who grilled this year? The rest of them did, but they're just extremely modest. All right. I'm sorry that I'm late. I always say that when I start.
There's a reason I'm always late.
All right. The mic I don't need. Thank you. Recorded. So really what I want to say, I can't say this to me. What I really want to tell these guys, I can't really say, can I? I can't really say what's on my mind. Okay. You guys will have to forgive me. I just have to gather my thoughts. I just finished speaking in the Vay for girls. I really don't want to tell you the same things I told them. Your sleeves are not long enough. See? Okay. He didn't get it. All right. Forget about it. I said his sleeves are not long enough. We got to wake you up. Come on, guys. Hello. Okay. All right. Wake you up. We're less than 24 hours away from Yom Kippur. Okay. So I'm going to really start off with a couple of questions. And I hope, Mitzvah Hashem, by the time I'm finished, I'll have them all answered. So the question is like this. The first question is, we're starting off Mitzvah Hashem tomorrow night. Kol Nidre, right? Everyone knows that. Start off Kol Nidre, all my promises and all the utterances that came out of my mouth and all the swearings that I made, that I meant, that I didn't mean. That's how you start off Yom Kippur. We end off Yom Kippur. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokim, Hashem Melech, Levino Malkeinu. That's how you should start Yom Kippur. First, from a Kabbal, Hashem, that you're God, you're the King, you're my Father, you're the only one. Now that we have Hashem's attention, and we call Him our Father and our King, now's the time, after that, to start praying to Him. But that we do at the end of Yom Kippur. At the beginning of Yom Kippur, sounds like it's not such an important thing to get up and start talking to Hashem. Well, you know, I made a promise that I would get up every day on time, and I didn't. And I promised my mother that I was going to make my bed every morning, and I didn't. And that's what Yom Kippur is all about. So why do we start Yom Kippur with something called Kol Nidre? Question number one. Question number two. What are the five inuyim, the five things that are painful that we don't do on Yom Kippur, is that we don't wear shoes. The question is, except for Tisha B'Av, which represents mourning, like if you lose somebody, since the Beis HaMidrash is stored on Tisha B'Av, so we're like a mourner, we're like an Avel. So on Tisha B'Av, we don't wear shoes because we're like an Avel. On Yom Kippur, we're not an Avel. Yom Kippur is a yontif. Yom Kippur is Shabbos, Shabbosom. Double Shabbos, right? What do shoes have to do with this? Why don't you wear shoes? If you're going to tell me because it's a fast day, Tanis Esther, Shavuos Tammuz, right? Sarbat Teves, they're all fast days. You wear shoes. So it's not because it's a fast day. So what is the thing on Yom Kippur that we don't wear shoes? And the third question is, you'll pay a little attention to it this year, Mitzvah Hashem. The third question is, in the middle of Musaf, actually right after the Musaf Tefillah, which is the Holy of Holies, is where we talk about the Korbanos that they brought in the Beis HaMikdash, and the Kohen Gadol went inside, and we were HaKohanim, we all get down on our knees, and we bow to Hashem. Musaf is where it's at, right? And right after we bring the Korbanos, all of a sudden, in the middle of nowhere, we say a piyut, we say the following. We talk about the Asare Heruge Malchus, the 10 great martyrs that were killed. What are they doing on Yom Kippur? What are they doing? Why are they part of this on Yom Kippur? It starts off in your art scroll, Machzor, on page 586. Eila Eskara, the Nafshi Elias Shvachot. These are the martyrs that I'm crying about, and we talk about Rabbi Akiva, he got raped to death, and we talk about Shimon Kohen Gadol, and we talk about all, they peel the skin off his face, all the terrible 10 tzaddikim that were killed, the terrible things that happened to them. In the middle of Musaf on Yom Kippur, we say it on Tisha B'Av. We said it already. We said it already this year. We said it in the keynote on Tisha B'Av. What are these 10 martyrs doing in the middle of Musaf on Yom Kippur? And if we're going to talk about them, why during Musaf? Why after the Kavanas? So I intend to Mirtz Hashem, I hope to answer these three questions. So let's start off with the question of Kol Nidre. I don't know if I said this here last year, but I tell you the story of the operation on the open heart. Anybody, by raise of hand, anyone know that story? Not enough. Appreciate it. Okay, so let me tell you a very fast story. So there was this young boy, and he was like 9 years old. He had to have an open heart surgery. They had to replace a valve. Very tricky operation in his heart. And there was one place in the United States of America that does this perfect. That was a very big hospital that was in Boston. And there was a very famous doctor that did this surgery. And he had a very famous team of doctors that worked with him. And this was the number one hospital. And the parents of the child came down. They checked. Hey, we're still in Lewis. They checked everything out. And they found out that this was the best way to do it. And they brought their child. And I'm going to cut to the chase. They had this operation. The doctor came in. He had his team, anesthesiologists, an assistant anesthesiologist, and an assistant to the assistant, and the guy who closes the chest, and the guy who opens the chest, and the famous doctor who does the actual operation. And it was the perfect, this is a dream team. Dream team. And they did the operation, and everything was perfect, and everything was great. They closed the kid up, they sent him upstairs to his room. 2 hours after the operation, he began to get fever, and then 4 hours later, he had higher fever, and the fever got higher and higher. 8 hours after he got the fever, he went into a coma. 12 hours after the operation, the child passed away. They called the doctor at home. They said, your patient passed away. He said, it's impossible. My hands are the hands, and nobody under my hands nothing can go wrong under my hands. And he rushes to the hospital, and he rushes up, and he finds out that it's true. His child passed away. He's beyond himself. Of course, he's not blaming himself. So he calls the team together, and he says, I want each one of you, all 12 of you, our rule is you have to have at least 8 hours of sleep. I want to see your time clock, I want to see your log, I want to see that you all slept exactly 8 hours or more. I want you to do blood tests, urine tests, I want to make sure there's no drugs, there's no alcohol, because there's no way that it was me. And everybody checks out, 8 hours, clean, everyone's clean, everything's perfect. The doctor turns around, he says, you know what? Okay. He goes up to the head of the president, the chairman of the board of the hospital, he says, listen, when I came out of medical school, I made up something with myself that any person that I operate on or a child that dies on the mic here, that's the last day I'm a doctor. And therefore, I'm handing in my resignation. I'm done. I'm finished. No hospital, no team, no nothing. I'm out of here. Of course, they built this hospital around this doctor. They were beyond themselves. They tried this, they tried that, they tried this. There was nothing to talk about. He was done. A little child died under his hands. He's finished. He goes into his office, and he starts to, you know, pack away the pictures on his desk and everything. He starts to pack it away. And all of a sudden, there's a knock at the door. And he's like, don't even try. I'm done. I don't want to talk to you people. And then the knock continues. He says, who is it? And he has a voice from the other side. It's Susie. Susie Schmoozy. I never heard of Susie. She's not on my team. I never saw her before. Not interested. Hello, Susie. I really have nothing to talk to you about. Have a nice day. I'm out of here. She stands there. She waits till he's ready to leave. He opens the door. There's this young 19-year-old girl standing by the door. She says, Doc, I have to talk to you. He says, I'm on my way out. What do you want? He says, Doc, I have to tell you, that child that you operated on today, it's my fault that the child died. He looks at her and he goes, what's your name? Susie? Susie, listen to me. I never saw you before in my life. You're not on my team. If the president decided to send you to try to get me to stay, to blame yourself, I'm not interested. I'm out of here. She says, no, doctor, I see you every day. Because you see me every day. Where do you see me every day? She says, I'm behind the curtain. My job in the hospital is that I take the tools that you use and I sterilize them. He says, okay, so what's the big deal? She says, I'll tell you what happened, doc. She says, you did an operation yesterday on that guy. He had a lot of infection and gangrene that you worked on. And they sent me back the tools and they sent me back to sterilize them. And this morning I came in and I wanted to put them in the wet box, in the hot box, whatever it's called. And as I was about to put them in, I got a phone call. And it was one of my friends, and she was in a dire situation, and I ended up talking to her for 20 minutes, and then all of a sudden, I heard from the loudspeaker that you needed your tools, and I didn't know what to do, and I knew we would have to be in the hot box for a long time, so I washed them off with cold water. I tried, but I knew that they weren't sterilized, but I had panicked, and I just wrapped them up in the gauze, made them look like they were sterilized, and I sent them into the room. See, Doc, you took those tools, and you used those tools in the heart, on the valve of that child. And all the infection from the patient before was on those tools, and it must have gone straight to the heart, and I'm really sorry I killed this kid. And I'm ready for the consequences. It had nothing to do with you. And the doctor looked at her and he said, it's amazing. Best doctor, best hospital, best team. Infected tool, patient's dead. The most meaningless person, not part of my team, because of you, we lost this child. True story. I took this story when I read it, and I brought it to Yom Kippur. We are surgeons on Yom Kippur. We got all kinds of cancers and diseases and aneshama that we need to cut out. What a surgery, Yom Kippur. We're cutting to save our lives. We're standing in front of Hashem on Yom Kippur, and the first decision that's made is chayim, is life or death. That comes all the money, shidduch, health, happiness. But if you're dead, money, shidduch, health doesn't make a difference. So the first decree on each neshama is life or death. And therefore, when we come to Yom Kippur, the tool that we use to cut away all those cancers. What are the cancers? Our avarice that we did a holy thing. All the thoughts, the terrible thoughts that we might have had that year. All the terrible deeds. It's sitting on our neshama. It's there. It's called a klipa. It's called an arla. It's sitting on your neshama. So, a holy Yom Kippur, we go in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we ask for forgiveness. Oshamnu, Boganu, Alchet, Alchet, Alchet. Every Alchet, cut another one off. Cut another cancer out. Cut another disease out. Every al-chait that you say. And you're using these tools and you're cutting away. Beautiful. You got the best surgeon. The best surgeon in the world is you. Because you know what you did. I don't know what you did. You know what you did. So you know without a sonogram, without an MRI, exactly where that cancer is. Exactly what that avera was. You're not going to take a sonogram. You're just going to look inside to yourself. I did this, I did this, Hashem, I'm sorry, I'm so much sorry. Al-Khait, Al-Khait. If you don't have to say Al-Khait, you can say it in your own words. I'm sorry, boom, that bear is gone. Boom, that bear, we spoke last year about tshuva. That bear is gone. You're doing the surgery. So you're the best surgeon in the world. And you got the best team. You're standing in a minyan, your Rebbe's there, Rosh Hashiva's there, Tzaddikim are there. Fantastic team. And you're in the best hospital in the world. You're in yeshiva, you're here, you're in a shul. You're at the Kotel. Wow. What a hospital. Best hospital, best surgeon, best team. But what's doing with the tool that you're using for the surgery? What's the tool that you're using for the surgery? Your mouth. The whole Yom Kippur is tefillah. So you could have the best surgeon and the best doctor and the best hospital and the best team. But if the tool that you're using, the mouth that you're using, has bacteria and is not sterilized, what's going to happen to the patient? What does that mean, it's not sterilized and has bacteria? Because that mouth spoke Lashon Hara. Because that mouth said nibble pear. Because that mouth answered back my mother or my father or my Rebbe or spoke about someone behind their back. So now we're coming before Yom Kippur, and we have this huge surgery. The first thing we need to do is sterilize the main tool that we're going to use, which is our mouth. Therefore, before you say Hashem O Elokim, before you say Shema Yisrael, before you say anything, you got to say Kol Nidre. All the promises I made with my mouth. All the utterance I said with my mouth, all the things I didn't keep that I said out of my mouth, the first thing I need to do is to clean my mouth. And how does one clean their mouth? by being very careful, especially in the next 22 hours, what comes out of it, to sterilize it overnight, to make sure that in the next 23 hours before Yom Kippur, we don't talk Lashon Hara, we don't talk bad about nobody, we definitely don't talk back to our parents, to call our parents and ask them mechila, to call anybody that we ever spoke bad about, don't tell them, by the way, I spoke heavy Lashon Hara about you, can you give me mechila? Because they'll never talk to you again. That would be very silly, because they'll say, what did you say about me? So of course we don't say that, we just say, listen, if I ever did anything wrong, are you Michael me? You don't have to go into prophet fire. I did this, and I said this to this one. That's not the way you do it. You just say, I'm asking you mechila for anything I did wrong. Now that I said that, every guy that's going to do it in this room, he'll think, you talk bad about me. No, that's what you have to ask. You have to ask mechila. And it's a very big thing. I know it's very hard, and I have no right, my Rebbe said, to ask anyone to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway, because that's the kind of guy I am. There are five inuyim on Yom Kippur. It's a very big thing by Hashem, if you can, if it's possible, to do, especially this Yom Kippur, a Tanis Divur. Tanis Divur means that from Kol Nidre until Ma'ariv, the following night after the Ila, you don't utter anything out of your mouth except Torah or Tefillah. And if you have to, someone asks you something, whatever it is, where's my pillow, where's my blanket, you go, but you don't talk. It has an unbelievable power. Tanis Divur. And if you have a Tanis Dibur, and I'm not asking you to do it, just if you want, I'm just giving you an idea. If you have a Tanis Dibur, you are sterilizing your mouth, and you're saying to Hashem that one day a year, I mamish didn't talk a word of nonsense, a bad word, but wasted one word out of my mouth. And that's sterilizing your mouth. And then at the end of Yom Kippur, when you scream Hashem Olakim, the surgery is going to be complete. When you say L'shan HaBab Yushalayim, it's going to be true. So that's why Yom Kippur begins with Dibur. In fact, if you look at right after Kol Nidre, we say, hold on, I'll take it a little out of order. We say, maybe I don't have it here. But when Moshe Rabbeinu said to Hashem, we need Slicha Kapara, so Hashem said, Salachti Kidvorecha. I'm forgiving you according to your words. So we see that even right after Kol Nidre, right? That's what it says. That the kapara of Hashem comes from our words. Now I'm going to tell you something tonight I don't think you've ever heard before, for a change. The power of speaking. Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, Salachti Kidvorecha. Your words, not your thoughts, not your machshavas, kidvorecha, according to your word. So I want to tell you something very fascinating. There's a Mishnah, I don't know what I'm doing my papers, but okay, we know this by heart. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says, I believe it's in the first perek, only the sixth Mishnah, that says, v'solachti, no, I'm sorry, not v'solachti, to, that a person has to be Donahab. That everyone in this room, every Jew, we have to judge the other Jew for the good. No matter how bad he's acting, no matter what you see him doing, you should judge him for the good. I remember when I was a kid growing up, I saw a guy in a car on Shabbos. Driving a car with a yarmulke. I said to my father, hey, look, he's in a car driving, he's Michal Shabbos. My father said, no, you have to think that he's going to pick someone up that's sick that has to go to the hospital. You know, he's not solid. Whatever. So when you see someone doing, a Jew doing something bad, you have to think that something good, there's something, you have to come up with some excuse for him. You have to be dan lecham schus every single Jew. Now, I don't understand how this works. It doesn't make sense. Because the bottom line, this guy's in a car on Shabbos, and he's driving. So, because I'm saying to myself, oh, he must be taking his wife to the hospital, even though his wife's not in the car, right? Or he forgot a Shabbos. He thinks it's Sunday. Or some other silly excuse that I'm coming up with. How am I helping him? Hashem knows the truth. How does me judging another Jew for credit, for good, help this guy? Hashem knows the truth. So if there's a guy that walks in and he embarrasses me in front of everyone else, and I'm like, Hashem, he didn't mean that. It was a joke. He was just joking. Hashem knows if he was joking or not. What good does it do that I'm saying he was joking? Hashem knows the truth. What does a human being learning tzchus on somebody, God knows the MS. How does that work? Very scary. So I'll tell you how it works. We're going to learn a little Gemara tonight, a little Taisvis tonight, a little Shita Mekubetzes tonight. Amazing stuff. When I said that in the day by the girl, they're like, Shita Mekubetzes? What's that? I don't have that book. Okay. But you guys do. Listen carefully. Let's get the Gemara. The Gemara says the following story. For all those who want to look it up tonight, because usually guys don't believe me when I say, so they're like, ready, where does it say? Bava Kama, Nun Omer Aleph, is a story like this. Kana Rabbanan, Maisa Bebita Shalach, he really doesn't trust me. There's a story about the daughter of a guy named Nechunya. What did Nechunya do? He used to dig cisterns, holes in the ground, fill them up with water, so the people, the Jewish people that would walk by, would have a place to drink water for their animals, for themselves. He was a big tzaddik. He did this for free. All he did all day, dig holes, fill them up with water, dig holes, fill them up with water, so all of us, when we went by, have a place to drink. What a tzaddik. One day, his daughter was walking by, and Nafal Lebargadol, she fell into one of the biggest, deepest ditches that the father dug. Okay? So they ran to the great rabbi, as Rabbi Hanina ben Daisa. They ran to Rabbi Hanina ben Daisa, right? And they said, pray for her. Amalehem, Shalom. Everything's okay. Don't worry. They ran back to the hole to see what's doing with her. She was under the water. They didn't see her anymore. They ran back to Rabbi Hanina ben Daisa. They said, she's drowning. Shalom. Everything's okay. Don't have to call out Shalom. All of a sudden, they came running back to him. And they said, Ulsa. She came out. She's on dry ground. She's alive. Okay. So they went over to this girl. And they said, Amrullah, no man, no human man could have gotten her out of this. You couldn't get that deep down and get out. So they said to her, Mihaela, who took you out of the ditch, out of this hole? Amru, she said, Lahem, Zacha shel Rechelim, a male sheep came, Vezakein Echad Manhigo, and an old man was leading him, and they took me out. Which we understand to mean the sheep was Yitzchak, right? And the old man was Avraham Avinu. Why? Since her father was doing chesed. So Avraham Avinu, who's chesed, he came with Yitzchak, and they saved him. Very interesting Gemara. It's brought down in one of the Mefarshim that it was actually he himself, that Rabbi Hanina ben Daisa was given the koyach to become like a malach, and he went in there, and he's the one who saved it. Okay, it doesn't matter who saved it. Okay. So now they're all excited, and they said, Ah, Hanina ben Daisa, we knew you were great, but did you wear a navi? We came running, and you said, Shalom. And then we came running, and you said, Shalom. Everything's okay. Only a navi would know that. Big man, you're a Navi. He said, Loi Navi Anaychi, Loi Ben Navi. I'm not a Navi, and I'm not the son of a Navi. He said, but I'll tell you how I knew. He said, Kacharmati, when you came to me right away, you told me that his daughter was drowning in this well that he dug. I said, Dabwa Sha'oisit, Tzaddik Mitzdaya Boy. The thing that this great Nechunya, this Tzaddik, was busy doing for Klal Yisrael, could it be Yikashabal Zaro, that his own daughter should die in the well that he's digging for Klal Yisrael? No, Hashem, you can't do that. Even if he deserved that his daughter should die, and she deserved that she should die in the hole that he made to help everyone else? No. A man gives an ambulance to Hatzalah, and Chas v'Shalom, his kid should be hit by that ambulance? Nah, come on. Can't happen. In the thing that he was doing for Chesed, and therefore, he said, I wasn't a Navi, but I knew, listen carefully, that the minute I davened to Hashem and I said these words, that Hashem, I know she's drowning, but you can't do that, because he dug the hole. I knew right away she'd be saved. Gemara goes on. Next line. Amar Rabbi Acha. Afa Pikein. Even though after this whole story I just told you, Meis Beno Batzama. The same Nechunya who dug the holes, his son died from thirst. Asks Taisvus, how could that be?
Rav Chanina Mendoza said that you can't die. The father made it. You should die in the thing. It's impossible. What did the father do? He was making wells of water so that everybody could drink. So how could his son die of thirst? Same question. So the Kaisis answers that in the hole that he dug, his children couldn't die. The son didn't die in the hole. In the water that he was putting in, his children couldn't drown. But just because he gave water to everyone else doesn't mean his son can't die of thirst. If his son would have drowned, you're right. But he didn't drown. That's what Tosfos says. Shita Mukhabetz says, well, what kind of answer is that? Come on, yeah. It's a loophole. The water is a result. He died of water and of thirst, and he was giving everyone that was thirsty water. I don't accept that. I don't understand that answer. He says something amazing. He says, look at the Gemara very carefully. In the first case, Chanina Mendoza got up and said, Hashem, you can't do this! He dug the wells, you can't do this! So she was saved, even though she was supposed to die. But when the son died of thirst, nobody got up and said anything. The son died somewhere out in the desert, nobody knew about it. So nobody got up and said, Hashem, how can he die from thirst? This man, even though maybe he deserved it, but this man is digging wells. But since nobody said the dibor, nobody said the words, therefore says the shita, the big shita, said, that's why he died. Now let's look at the Mishnah. Have a done kolod l'mechav schus. If you see a guy, this is an amazing, mind-opening shot, what I'm about to tell you. You see someone driving on Shabbos. Well, okay, before I get to that, there's another Gemara. I'm not going to get into this Gemara, but the Gemara talks about, in Shemayim, there was a big machlekes between Hashem and the Bezen Shalmaila about a certain negat saras, if it's tohar or tameh. Hashem paskin, that it's tohar. The Rambam paskins that it's tameh. Because in Mishnah, how could the Rambam paskin against God? The fact that God said it's tar. Rambam came along and said it's tar. And they asked, how could you ask? The Terence is, why by Shemayim here? What we paskin on this world, even if in Shemayim God paskins against it, it goes by what we paskin. Many times in the Gemara, you'll see a baskel came out, and a baskel came out, and a baskel came out, and Bezin said, have a nice day. We don't paskin according to a baskel. We paskin according to the way we paskin, and if we paskin this day's Rosh Chodesh, even if it isn't, it becomes Rosh Chodesh. I'll take you a step further. If Bezdin, witnesses come and say, this guy's a murderer, and Bezdin does all their checking, and they paskin, Bezdin gets up, Reuven is a murderer, he's chayav miso. Finished. They're taking him out to kill him, and the two witnesses come running that said all that bad about him and said, we made it up. We have witnesses. We said we saw the murder in Yerushalayim, that we were in Florida that week. And we have witnesses that we were in Florida. We are Edim Zomimim. We are liars. The halacha is too late. You kill him. He's 100% innocent. He's innocent. There are Edim that have come and said, it was too late. It was after the Gzar Din. After Bezdin says the Din, you can't. He dies. And they can be proven the biggest lies in the world. Halacha is he dies. You can't change it after Bezdin makes halacha. That's the way it is. They go out and they kill him. Nothing you can do. And vice versa. If he's found innocent, and the halacha and the din they paskin that he's innocent, and then the Edom come and say, we're lying. We told you he was with us in Florida. He wasn't in Florida. This guy is so guilty. It's too late. He's innocent. The best thing on this world, we have such, the koyach that a human being has on this world is amazing. I'll tell you another one. It says that if you have a bar, a hole in the ground, that's 10 tlachim, 10 fists, right? And someone falls in and dies, yichayim misa, because 10 fists can kill a person. 9? You're not chayim. So they went to a rabbi, and there was a hole. And they wanted to know if this hole is a killer hole. The rabbi was a little guy about this big. His hands were teeny. His 10 fists was about this much. And he paskined. did his 10 fists, right? That was how big the hole was. It was his 10 fists. He passed it. This hole can kill someone, even though it was only this big because he had teeny little fists. They went to another rabbi. And this guy's 9 fists, he was huge. He was a 7'2 guy, was this big. And therefore, that hole, halacha, according to that rabbi, he's the one who measured it, is not enough to kill someone. So this hole could kill someone, and this hole can't. Why? Because this rabbi has little fists, and this rabbi has... Do you know what it says? It says that since this rabbi has little fists, and the Gemara, and the halacha, if he has 10 fists, he could kill someone, there'll be a new bria, a new creation, a new teva, a new change in nature. That since it's his 10 fists, Shemayim will change, that in that little hole it's possible to kill you. And the other guy's 9 fists, which is much bigger, won't kill you. What we do on this world, la halacha, the other world, will change this world to that halacha. So now listen. So now there's a guy driving on Shabbos, and he's driving by, and I say, Hashem, I'm down the Chavschus. He's driving on Shabbos, Hatzalah, he forgot what day it is, it's an emergency, he's got to go run after his wife, for whatever reason, I don't know, there's a kid in the back seat I can't see that something happened to. So you passed in La'alocha, that guy's okay, he didn't do an Aveira. Now they go to Beth Shalmaila, and Beth Shalmaila says, what are you talking about, that's got a chal Shabbos? He went to get to the movies on time in the middle of Shabbos. Too late, Beth Shalmaila, you can't change what I passed. Habedan kolon l'chavschus. If you judge every Jew l'chavschus, l'chavschus, to the side of schus, then in Shemayim they can't judge against you. What a crazy power. But what about chas v'shalom the other way? You see a guy doing something good, and you say, I know why he's doing it. He wants to get close to the Rebbe so he can go to his house for lunch on Shabbos. He doesn't care about learning. You paskin! But he doesn't care about learning. You paskin, that his whole learning is a fake. And Shemayim, that paskin, that his learning is real. Because you're wrong. Too late. Since you paskin l'chaiva, Shemayim, they can't turn over. The first guy to run with it is the Satan. And he says to Hashem, I'm not saying anything. Chas v'shalom. One of your Jewish boys is Makatri. The beach tzaddikim. Their koyach, Moshe Rabbeinu's koyach, was in the worst thing. Not to be Makatrik. What's the raya to this? Even if they're doing the wrong thing. Eliyahu HaNavi said to Hashem, Kla Yisrael is not doing bris milah. We were not doing bris milah. It's true. He ran in front of Hashem and said, they're not doing bris milah. Hashem said, you are Makatrik on my nation. Your punishment is that every time a Jew does a bris, you got to go to that bris. And you got to eat the bagels and the eggs. I don't care how bad they are. You got to go to that bris, and you got to come to Shemayim, and every single Jew that does a bris, you have to come in front of my throne, just like you told me they're not doing it, and they weren't doing it. And you're going to have to say, by every Jew, I'm a witness. Chaim did it. Moshe did it. Reuben did it. Yehuda did it. In Australia, did it. In Mexico, every single bris. And he doesn't want to be here. This is Eliyahu Malach HaBris. He wants to be in Shemayim. How dare you open your mouth, Eliyahu HaNavi, and talk bad about my children, even when they're bad. Yeshaya HaNavi. They gave him so much trouble. He got up and he said something bad about Klai Yisrael. It says that he was hiding in a tree from the Goyim, and they took an axe, and they cut down the tree, not knowing that it was there. And that's how he was killed. He was killed, the hatchet went right through his neck. And it brings out in the Medrash, you know why? Because from his neck, from his mouth, came bad words about Klai Yisrael. That were true! So his punishment was Mida Kenegi Mida Yishaya Novi. You're not allowed to talk bad about the Jews. We are not allowed to talk bad about the Jews. Because when we talk bad about the Jews, we're the Beis Din. And then Hashem, Beis Din Shamayla, can't change it. But we're allowed to talk good about the Jews. And we know that there were many big tzaddikim that only, no matter how bad you were, they found something good in you. Avraham Avinu found something good in a bunch of Arabs. Forget about Jews. He found good in Saddam. Come on. The worst human beings in the world. They put you on a bed if you were tall, they cut your feet off. If you were short, They slept you. They took a girl, they put her full of honey, and hung her in front of a beehive. I mean, hello. What did Abraham Avinu do? Abraham Avinu, any one of us would have said, burn them! Destroy them! Kill them, Hashem! Wipe off the face of the earth! Abraham Avinu said, how about 100? How about 50? How about 20? How about 10? How about 10? Would you save the whole place of 10? And Hashem said yes. Why did Hashem say yes? Take the 10, move them out, and then destroy them. Because Abraham Avinu was coming from their Bria, they're sugar. But you have to learn chus on them. So the most important thing, everybody's talking about Mashiach. Everyone, Rav Wassi, did you hear this story? The lady in the nursing home, and the lady who came back, who was in a coma, and it's Matzei Shviyas, and it's Tachamas coming, the benching of the sun, and all the simanim, the stock market's crashing. Everyone wants Mashiach when the stock market crashes. Stock market's crashing, want Mashiach. The Yankees are not anyway in the World Series, and the Mets are not in the World Series, so Mashiach doesn't disturb right now. You know, who cares about Boston? Doesn't make a difference, you understand? You know, so and the guys from Chicago, they're also out, I think, so you know. So everyone's ready for Mashiach! All our teams are not here. The guys from LA are doing pretty well, right? But. So he, you know, he's like Hashem. Wait 2 weeks; they might win the World Series. Then I want Mashiach. But anyone wants Mashiach, and all the simanim are there. But why? There's one big problem that you're not thinking about. Does Hashem want Mashiach? Why doesn't Hashem want Mashiach? Because there's about 1 million of us, nice religious Jews, but there's 10 or 12 million out there that don't even know they're Jews. What's going to happen to them when Mashiach comes, guys? So you think Hashem wants to save 1 million of his children and destroy 12 million of them? He's got a problem. If he brings us Mashiach, those guys, Shabbos, kosher, intermarriage, forget about it. He doesn't want to lose those children. So, if all us children get up on Yom Kippur, the Yom Kippur, and we turn around to Hashem and say, you know, I have a cousin, he's not religious. He married a non-Jewish woman, but you know, Hashem, it's not his fault. He doesn't come from a religious family. He doesn't even know he's a Jew. Hashem, it's not his fault. His name is... I paskin, it's not his fault. We got another one from Mashiach. And this whole group of people, they don't know nothing about it in Reform. They're brought up Reform. They don't know nothing. They see a woman, rabbi, a woman, Mayel, I don't know, woman, everything, whatever it is. They're like totally out of their mind. Hashem, it's not their fault. They're brought up that way. If we, the ones who know, Adam Chaschus, the ones who don't know, then we're paskining in this world. And in the next world, they have to accept them. I know everybody has lists of names that they put in their machzer to write about people who are sick and should daven for. But how many guys have in their machzer their cousins who aren't religious to daven for, and their friend that's not religious so they went to public school with to daven for? That's what Hashem wants to see. He understands that you're davening for the chaylim. But the Chaylim, even if they die, they have a world to come. These people have no world to come. So we need to have lists of cousins, of friends, of names, who don't even know that you're doubting for them, and say to Hashem, believe me, I know this guy. If he only knew, if he was in Or Samech, if he only knew, he'd be much bigger than me. You paskin like that? He's bigger than you. What a karach. Amazing strength that we all have. We have that koyach. We need to use that this Yom Kippur. Because Mashiach is standing at the door. But there's a problem. There's too many of us that are not going to make it. We got to bring them in. We bring them in, we're ready. He's here. So we have to daven for all the nitche, all the Jews who are never pushed out, who don't know. And the guys that you know by name, write that name down. Put in your machzor, cry for him. Or them. Or family members, whoever it is. Or yourself. Okay. So that answers Kol Nidre. We know that the power is the power of the mouth. The next thing is, who's really giving judgment tomorrow? Who's giving judgment, Yom Kippur? You guys aren't going to Shemayim, I hope not. If you are, give me a number after Yom Kippur. I'd like to know, especially if you come back. We don't stand in front of Hashem. None of us are going to stand in front of Hashem tomorrow. Our souls, our neshamot, are standing in front of Hashem. We're down here. A neshama is going up there. So what kind of neshama are you sending up there? Let me tell you a little story. So there was this young prince, and in the old days, they used to marry off guys, princes, without choices, because it was all political stuff. you know, you wanted Austria to be together with this other country, so you took the princess of Austria with the prince of England, and you married them together, then Austria and England were connected. That's what they used to do, set up marriages. So this prince was a hotshot, cool character, had his own head, and one day his father says to him, listen, we just found a beautiful princess, this country we want to make peace with, tomorrow night you're getting married. No choice. This is what happens in royalty, you have no choice. The next night they get married, he is so upset. Nobody forces anything on me, but he has no choice. And they get married, they're under the chuppah, whatever, they come down, they sit down by the table, he turns to her and he says, listen, I don't know you, I don't like you, and I don't ever really want to see you again. I'm not into this whole political thing. I want to marry someone that I chose in the Chiras Libo. Some guys write that on their invitations, which is the silliest thing I've ever seen. I'm getting married because I chose her. What did you choose? You choose nothing. 40 days before you came into this world, Hashem chose her. So don't be like, in Bechiras Libo, I chose her. Better you didn't choose. If it's Bechiras Libo, then it becomes a human thing and it may not last. But if it's Hashem chose, I don't understand why that's on invitations. They think it's romantic. But first of all, if you want it to be romantic, then don't write it in Hebrew, write it in English. And that I never saw. So, in Bechiras Libo. He said, I want to choose my queen, but you know what? I got no choice. My father did this, so you know what? In the corner, in the attic of the castle, that's where you're going to be. And he sends her off with the servants into the corner. He doesn't want anything to do with her. Forced on me? Feck. I have nothing to do with her. But what could he do? That's what his father did. He goes out with his friends. They go hunting. They play polo, whatever they're doing. They're having a great time. A few months later, his father dies. And he becomes the king. Aha. So now, in Bechiras Libo, I'm going to find myself a queen. And he goes out and he hangs out. He goes to this place, to that place, to that place. He meets this girl. She's beautiful. She's this, she's that. He marries her. They're married for 40 years. And some good times, some bad times. Not bad. You know, 40 years, pretty good. He's like 65, 69, let's say close to 70 at this point. He's married to her. He's bored with her. He says, you know what? I got to get myself a young girl. So he goes out, and he says, I'm the king, I can marry as many women as I want. And he meets one night, this guy introduces to his 19-year-old beauty, mamash a model, and he's like, wow, she would be like a great person to have when I go to parties, and when I go, you know, to court. And he, you know, he starts talking to her, and she knows he's the king, and he's a multi-billionaire, even though he's 7 years old, and he's old, and he's bald, and he's wrinkled, and whatever. But he's got money, right? So she marries him, and this fool, there's nothing worse than an old fool. This fool, you see these guys, you know, on the West Side Highway, I don't know if you've ever seen it. I've seen it many times. I see this crazy Italian sports car, like a Testarossa, you know, like a $250,000 beautiful Ferrari. And I'm like, I got to see who's driving that thing, right? And the top's down, you drive up next to it, and you see this old guy sitting there, no hair on his head, with just a little ponytail in the back of a rubber band, right, with sunglasses. And like, I'm thinking to myself, what are you doing in that car? I should be in that car. But, you know, when you get to that age, you want to be young, so you surround yourself with young things. So this guy also was an old fool. 19-year-old girl, he marries her. He's so happy, and of course, you know, when men make that mistake, they make that mistake, and he thinks she loves her, and she buys him a cake on his birthday. Yeah! He goes to every party with his beautiful, you know, beauty queen over here, and everyone's like, whoa, the king got a 19-year-old. Whoa, everyone's going crazy, like, you know? Okay. A year later, he gets deathly ill. And he's laying in his deathbed. The doctor says, yeah, you got a couple of hours, man. You don't got much time. And he thinks to himself, nope. He's very scared to leave this world by himself. Scary thing. So he calls in this girl. Now she's 20. It's a year later. And I have to be careful. I have to be careful because I don't say every minute, you know, I'll get at the end of the whole list of shoes. You said he had green socks. And at the end, you said he took off his black socks. The whole thing's not true, Rabbi! So I got to be careful with my details that they, you know, stay in the right place. So now she's 20. Because it was a year, and then he got sick? Okay, good. Anyway, he calls her into the room. He says, darling, sweetie, you've been amazing to me this last year, and I have a few hours left. I have these two cyanide pills. I would like you to lay down next to me and take them, and the two of us will die together and go to heaven together. Oh, what a book, right? Ah, Romeo and Juliet. She turns around to him and says, you old geezer, you fool, you think I like you? I despise you. You smell. You're old. You're wrinkled. I'm waiting for you to die. You'll take the cyanide pills.
I'm not.
She said, I can't wait because the minute you die, I already have them lined up. Got this young 22-year-old guy. I'm going to take your money. We're going to travel the world. And he's looking at him. But you, every night you said you loved me. And you bought me cards. And you were smiling. What are you talking about? She goes, I love you. I can't wait till you're gone. She turns around and she runs out. And this king's laying on his bed. He's gasping for air. He's like, oh, my gosh, what did I do? He says, oh, but my wife of 41 years.
Eh? 1 year, 41. Okay, good.
My wife of 41 years, she'll go with me. So he sends his servant out, and the servant comes in and with the wife, and the wife says, wow, you look miserable. He says, listen, 41 years of two of us. I know I made a mistake marrying that 19-year-old. It was a mistake, and I'm sorry, and I apologize. I have these two pills, cyanide pills. It's a long time together. Could you lay down next to me and take these two pills, and we'll go to heaven together? She looks at him. She says, I have to admit, you've been pretty good to me. But I'm not going anywhere with you. But I'll tell you what. To show you my love, I promise you, I will never marry again. He's looking at her like, okay, what, you know. She turns around. She walks out. And there he is in his bed alone with a couple of minutes left. He's dying. It's over. And the two people that he gave his whole life to, and money and everything, gone. All of a sudden, there's a very slight little rap at the door. He says, who is it? He hears a voice on the other side. It's the princess. The princess, what are you talking about? The princess, you married me all those years ago. You sent me to my room. Can I come in? He says, oh my goodness, I totally forgot about her. She walks into the room, old, bent, twisted, wrinkled. Her hair looks like it hasn't been washed in 50 years, streaked with filth. The wedding gown that she was still wearing, filthy, ripped. A woman out of a nightmare. He never saw anything like that in his life. And she looks at him and she says, I'll take those pills. I'll lay down and I'll die with you. He says, you? You, I put into your room by yourself? Never sent you clothing, never sent you food, didn't even set up a place for you to wash yourself, totally forgot about you. You're willing to die with me? How could that be? And they're not. And she turned to him. She said, I'll tell you why. She said, from the day I met you on that wedding night, I felt so crazy in love with you. And you should know that all these years you were walking around the palace, I was right behind you. You said you never wanted to see me again, so I went from this column to that column to this column to that column, hoping that maybe you'll turn around and maybe you'll see me and maybe we'll be together again, and crying every single night. You never turned around. And then you married that woman, and then you married that woman. He said, but, sire, my king, once you die, I have nothing in this world. And therefore, I want to die with you. She got into the bed. She took the two cyanide pills. And the two of them died together. Rabbi, what are you doing? A Romeo and Juliet story for us tonight. It's Erev Yom Kippur. Crazy story. Crazy story. Anyone know anyone like that? Good. Yeah. You're all like that! Every one of us! Says the Dogma HaMagid. Including me. You come into this world as a goof, a baby is born, and Hashem takes a neshama, takes a soul, and puts it into that baby. By force. Not the Chiras Lipo. Puts that holy, holy spiritual being into this goof. And the goof says, I don't want any part of you. Go into your corner. I want to be busy eating, sleeping, drinking, growing, playing ball, going to business, going to college. Everything and anything besides paying attention to that soul. You know why? I didn't ask Hashem for this. I asked Hashem to be born a Jew. I asked Hashem for the soul. And we put her that neshama in the corner of our goof somewhere, and we pay no attention. We feed the goof. We get married. And I don't mean to a woman. We get married to this world. And we're busy with this food and that food and better food and this restaurant, that restaurant, this car and that clothing, this shoe and that. We're very busy for 40 years. Busy, busy, busy. Some good times, some bad times. Just like the middle, the woman in the middle. The neshama, the most precious princess that loves us more than anything else in the world. Where, what, who, when. I'm more interested in the Yankees. I'm more interested in my sports team. I'm more interested in my marks on my tests. I'm more interested in girls. I'm more interested in my music. Neshama, stay in your room in the corner. And then when we get older, you guys don't know about this yet. When you get older, like 60 years old, 50, 60 years old, it's a very big word. It's called security. Investment, my money's here, my money's there. It's in the life insurance, it's in this policy. It used to be in the stock market, it's here, it's over there, it's everywhere. Because I need security, because I'm not working anymore after I'm 68. So where am I going to get my money? So I have to be very secure, and it's secure, and it's very important. Money, 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 money for me, money for my house, money for my kids, money for my grandkids. Like, we can control the parnassah of our children, our grandchildren, comes from Hashem. You can leave $10 million, they can lose it, I can tell you stories. Lose it in 5 seconds in gambling. You can't control anything. But we're very, very, very important. Security, security, security. I don't know what's going to happen. I hold it, money, 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 materials, everything has to be paid off, my mortgages, everything. That's what's important. And then after 120 years, when you're laying on that deathbed, and it's pretty scary, and you turn around and you say, oh no, I'm going to Shemayim. I don't want to go alone. Money, 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 money. Beautiful princess. Where I walk around all the time and I'm showing it to everybody. This is who I am. What I gather, my materialistic belongings. That's what I am. And that's what I'm busy showing everyone. New money, are you coming with me? Are you coming with me to the next world? We get buried without pockets. And the money turns around. Tell you what the money tells you. Tells the neshama and the goof. Ha! You're an old man anyway. You're no more fun. You don't gamble anymore. You don't put the money in the market anymore. You're boring. You don't buy yourself cool clothing and great cars. I'm a hot shot money. I like to be used for good things and cool things. You know what? When you die, you know where I'm going? To your grandchildren, to your children, to someone else's children. Have a nice day. Bye. And all of a sudden, you start to panic. Oh, my goodness, all that work. All those years. Work, 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 work. Doesn't want any part of me. My family. Family. My family. Cousins, brothers, aunts, uncles, fathers, brothers, sisters. My family. Okay. 50, 60 years, I'm with my family. Family, new. You coming with me to the next world? No. They go from the Levaya. They take forest. They put you in the ground. Everybody turns around. They walk. They say Shiva. Nobody goes with you. But they say, Dad, you got my word. You're a good dad. So you'll be my only dad. I'll have a picture of you. I'll tell my children, Dad, you're my dad. Why? Husband? You're the husband. Maybe she'll marry him, maybe she won't. All the people that you know, all your relatives, they will never, they're good to you. You spent 40 years, 50 years, 60 years with them. We'll never forget you. We're going to make a book and an album and Zecher Nishmas on the wall and Zecher Nishmas maybe on the outside of the yeshiva. But the bottom line is, sorry, we can't go. And there you are, the last minute of your life. And the family can't go with you, and your money can't go with you. And there's a knock on the door. Who are you? I'm the neshama. Hello, goof. Remember me? And Nebuchadnezzar, that neshama looks beaten, dirty, starving, ripped to pieces. And you're like, what are you doing here? And neshama says, Chaya! From the minute you were born, I was watching you. Every second of a person's life, I'm there behind the door, behind the scene, waiting for you to turn around and look at me. To look at your spirituality and forget about your physical being. And I kept wondering, I love you and I love you and I watch you and I watch you. You're busy with this and you're busy with that and you're busy with this. You never turn around to look at me. But Chaim, I'm your neshama and I can't live on this world without your goof. So therefore, if you go, I go. We go together. And the president sits here and says, oh my goodness, the one thing I should have given the most attention, that never separated from me, that loved me the most, that cared for me the most, my neshama, I get the least attention. as busy with food, with football, with all the other stupidities in the world, and the soul food, I never gave him anything to eat. I was busy, I had to get out of Davin and get my children off. Shift too long. Yeah, get me out of here. I don't like her. And then it's too late. So you have about 18 hours left. And everyone in this room, including me, our neshama is going to stand in front of Hashem. What's it going to look like? Ripped clothing, thin, disheveled, bent over. What's Hashem going to see? If he sees your neshama that looks like that, he's going to say, this is not a shidduch, this neshama and this guf. This guf doesn't give this neshama any attention. So if that's the case, why do they need to be together anymore? And then chas v'shalom, the person's written in the book of death. But if the neshama shows up and it's beautiful, shh, look at the attention that the guf is giving to that neshama that I sent down to the world. We got to keep them together this year. This is a beautiful marriage. So you have about 17 hours to dress up your neshama in beautiful clothing, wash its hair, trim its beard, give it to eat, give it to drink. If you have to stay up all night and learn, daven, do tshuva, whatever you got to do. But make sure that tomorrow night when you come to Kol Nidre, that neshama is a beautiful neshama. And everybody in this room has the koyach to do that. That neshama loves you more than anything else in this world. Most of the time, including yourself. I want to end to answer the two questions that I asked about shoes and why we read the Ten Harugei Malchus. We have to know that everything we do, Ben Adam L'Chavero, how we treat another person, lasts forever. The selling of Yosef HaTzadik by the Shvatim was never forgiven. The Rabbeinu Bechaya says that Yosef HaTzadik never said, I'm Meichel you. At the end of Vayichi, they came to him and they asked for Mechila, and he said something like our parents always say, no, you don't need Mechila, everything's Bashar. Hashem wanted me to be sold in Mitzrayim, so I should run Mitzrayim. And he never gave them the word Mechila. Rabbeinu Bechaya says, if he would have said the word Mechila, Mashiach would have been here. You need to say the word Mechila. But because he didn't say that, the Mekatrig, the Satan, comes every Yom Kippur, every Rosh Hashanah, and gets up in front of Hashem and says, I hear everything, he says, Mekatrig, everything, the Jews are great, blah, 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 blah. Hashem, answer me how they sold their brother. That's the biggest Kitrig has been for Klai Yisrael from the day we sold Yosef HaTzadik. Let me read for you from the Chumash, and then I'll let you guys go. What happened when we sold Yosef? He says the following. We're going to need this, we're going to need this, we need this. The following. Vayihi kasher bo Yosef elechav. Yosef approached his brothers. Vayavshitu es Yosef eskutantoi. They took off his shirt, undershirt. Eskusainas hapas mashalom and eskusainas pas. They ripped off his shirt, they ripped off all his clothing. They asked the kasher, I don't understand. He was wearing a eskusainas pas, a multicolored jacket. That's what they were jealous of. Why don't they just take his jacket off? Why do they rip all his clothing off? So it says that they were in the heat of their kanos, that they were doing the right thing. They just ripped, and everything came off. Very important thing for people who are in chinuch, for people who teach. When you teach someone and he does something wrong and he hurts you, just take off what he did. Don't rip the guy to pieces. That was their mistake. Take out the outer, it's not him, it's not the person. Because the person does something wrong, that's his outer jacket. Take off the jacket. You have to criticize him. Take him in a corner. Take off the jacket. But don't, in your zeal to be right, rip everything off him. Don't rip his soul and his heart. But Yosef HaTzadik, they were so anxious, they were so right, that they just ripped everything off. And they threw him into the bar. Naked. Is it? That's what they did. Vayishlolabar. What did they do right after that? That was a pretty heavy thing, taking your brother and throwing him into a bar that has snakes. But Yeshua Lech Olechem, they sat down to have lunch. Yosef in the bar? Okay, let's go to Sino steak sandwiches and burgers and fries. That's what they did. They sat down to eat. One. Two, actually one is they ripped off his jacket. We know what they did with his jacket. They dipped it in the blood They came to Yaakov. They didn't say, they said, they said, this is what we found. Yaakov saw blood on the jacket. He thought that's what they were trying to fool him. They took a goat, they shechted it, they took the blood, and they made it look like that Yosef, it was Yosef's blood, and Yaakov thought it was Yosef's blood, and that was on the Ksonis Pasa. So the first thing they did was they took off the Ksonis Pasa. That was the first thing. The second thing they did was they sat down to eat, like they didn't care. And the third thing was the following. Vayimkuru as Yosef l'Shmeelim be'esrim kesef. They sold Yosef to the Ishmaelim for 20 silver dollars. Those are the three things that they did. Because Yosef never said Mechila, we have been punished through all the generations because of this. We all know that Sari Ruge Malchus that we're going to say in Yom Kippur, each one represented a brother, as it says, they represented a brother that sold Yosef. The whole thing was about selling Yosef. But we also know that had Hashem punish us for the other three things that he did, so first of all, they sat down to have a meal. So if you learn in Megillas Esther, it says that after Haman and Achashverosh wrote that we're going to be wiped off the earth, right? And there was an edict was distributed that we're going to be destroyed. So what did the king do? He just decided to destroy millions of his people. What did he do? Bahamelech, Bahaman, Yashvu Lishtais. He sat down to eat lunch. Mida Keneged Mida. Hashem said, you brothers, when your brother was in danger of dying, you sat down to eat lunch. One day, when your brothers are in danger of dying again, somebody else is going to sit down to eat lunch. Achashverosh and Haman. So that was the Mida Keneged Mida that they sat down to eat lunch. The great tzaddik said that the blood libels, which I'm sure you've heard, hundreds of thousands of Jews were killed for many, many years in Poland and in Russia and in Europe, that the non-Jews would kill a little non-Jewish boy, take his blood, and make believe that we use that for our four cups of wine and for our matzah. Where do they even think they're going to get away with such a stupid thing? Blood! Matzah! Go taste my wine! Go taste my matzah! What blood? Where? And this great tzaddik said, this is a punishment that the brothers took that animal's blood and made it believe that it was human blood. So the punishment is that the goyim are making believe that the wine, the opposite way we're getting punished, that the wine is really blood. Just like that blood wasn't really the blood that it was supposed to be, so now this blood is not really the blood that it's supposed to be. And that's all the Jews that died in the blood libels never suffered because they dipped the kesinus in the blood. The third thing is like this. When you read this, the Ten Harugei Malchus, so the first thing the king did, Gobalei Migdolim, it became a big shot. V'tzivo l'malois platero na'olim. He filled up his whole palace with shoes. You're going to kill 10 tzaddikim. What are you, a king, in those days, filling up his palace with shoes? Why? So he said why. It's very clear. You don't need anyone to tell you this. He said, where are the 12 shvat, 10 shvatim that sold your brother? They're not here. What did they sell them for? They sold them to Yishma'elim. They sold Yosef for a bunch of shoes. Now, why did they sell Yosef for a bunch of shoes? Very interesting. I'm not going to quote it inside, but there's two reasons. One, they say that when they got the 20 silver dollars, they said, what are we going to do with it? Buy matzah? Buy cake? Buy can't. It's a trade for money. What are we going to buy with trade for money? That money's from selling our brother. We're not going to buy tilling. So they said, you know what? We'll buy shoes. Shoes are the lowest thing in the world. We'll buy shoes. They have no kedusha. And they went and they bought shoes. Each one got a pair of shoes, all 10 of them. He brings down the safe for something totally different. He says that Hashem, when he saw that Yosef was naked in the bar, Hashem sent Malach. Yosef was wearing a kameya around his neck. And from that kameya, the Malach made clothing. Listen to this amazing story he brings down. So now they pull, it's an interesting story. They pull him out of the bar and they see he has clothing. And the Jews turn to the Ishmaelim and say, hold it. We sold you him naked for $20. The clothing's worth more. You gotta pay us for the clothing. So the Ishmaelim turned around and said, we paid you already the $20, we're not giving you any more money. So the Ishmaelim said, you know what? He has clothing, we'll give each one of you a pair of shoes for his clothing. That's how they got the shoes. So where did we get punished for that? Ramesh, right before your generation, right before my generation, we got punished for that. If anybody ever went to Yad Vashem, anybody ever went to the Holocaust museums, if anybody ever went to Auschwitz or to any of these places, the Nazis did a very crazy thing. They decided for some reason that after they take a Jew and they put him in the crematorium and they put him in the gas chamber, they're going to take his shoes. And they're going to collect shoes. Not jackets, which are worth a lot more, not sweaters, not shirts, not underwear, not socks, shoes. And they were going to take all these shoes and fill up 6 million pairs of shoes in a huge, this was their plan, in a huge building. And that's how they're going to show the next generation that they killed 6 million Jews, because a pair of shoes is a human being. Not your hat, not your jacket, not your tefillin, not your tzitzis. You're not going to find piles of any of that. But piles of shoes, warehouses. I saw the pictures. Warehouses of children's shoes, a million children's shoes. Warehouses of our grandparents' shoes. Great-grandparents' shoes. Why? Why did the Nazis come up with collecting Jewish shoes? Why did this Russia fill up a palace of shoes? And the answer is, to be a machaber that the Shvatim sold Yosef, your brother, for shoes. How many thousands of years later Hashem held back till the Holocaust happened for selling their brother for shoes? Chas v'shalom that any of us should sell our brother for anything. And that means when someone comes for your help, you got to be there for them. And this Yom Kippur, we're going to bring Mashiach. And the way we're going to bring Mashiach is to take all these people who don't know about Yiddishkeit and to daven for them and be don them for Chatzchus that HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When you bring Mashiach, all his children can be there, not just us. That's our job. And if we do that, I'm not a Navi, that's for sure. It says that Neviyus is given to fools and children and women. I hope I'm none of the three. But I'll tell you this, and this is my bracha, and it's going to sound a little weird, don't get nervous. My bracha to everyone in this room, you should be zeicha to see, not what that Iranian Meshuggah wants, but I'm telling you that in Mitzvah Hashem, here is going to be a pile of shoes, not 6 million shoes, maybe 18 million shoes. A pile of Jewish shoes? You never saw a pile like that in your life. But it's going to be a different pile than the Holocaust. The Mishnah and Brachas. You can't come on to Har HaBayis when the Beis HaMikdash is in existence with shoes. The Mishnah says, leave your stick and leave your shoes. You're not allowed to walk on the Har HaBayis in shoes. Which means that when Mashiach comes, every Jew, when they come to the Har HaBayis, when they come to the Beis HaMikdash, when we're going to march all together, we're going to stop and throw our shoes into this crazy pile of shoes. My bracha to myself and my bracha to you. My father used to always say this Erev Yom Kippur, may I see you barefoot very soon. First time he said that to me, I said, Dad, that means no more allowance? And he said, no, we're Kohanim. Kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash have to be barefoot. My bracha to you is, to all the Kohanim here, that together with me, Mirtzah Hashem B'Karav, we should be barefoot in the Beis HaMikdash, and all you guys, Mirtzah Hashem, should see that, and we should take and see this pile of shoes to give us a Yeshua, to give us a feeling that they took away 6 million pairs of shoes, we're going to put back millions and millions of pairs of shoes. And the only way we can do that is to daven for our brothers and to dress up that neshama in the next couple of hours, so that when we stand in front of Hashem, it makes sense, the shidduch that he made by force. And then he'll come, and the shidduch that's also made at the end of time is the shidduch of God in us. May that happen in the very near future. Hatzlacha and a good fast.
You've just experienced another Torah class brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.